This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Everyone, I am Sally, and I am Manchester's resident pulsar hunter. You may have seen the back of my head on Stargazing Live. but I am going to host the Ask an Astronomer session. So first of all, I'll let you all introduce yourselves one by one. Just say your name. This is going to be the panel who will be answering your questions, starting at this end.
Okay, I'm Stuart Lowe.
I'm Ian Harrison.
I'm David Alt.
Ian Morrison.
Mark Perver.
Chris Lintott.
George Bendo.
Jen Gupta.
Okay, great. And I believe some of you have got questions that you're going to read out. And we are going to start with Eleanor.
If the universe is growing, what is it growing into? And if we could go to the edge, could we get out?
And I'll pose that to Jen and Mark.
Yeah, I think I volunteered to kick this one off. Nice and simple. Thank you for that question. That's a really good question. I love answering this question because I find it really hard to think about. Because if you talk to cosmologists, and I spend most of my time talking to cosmologists in Portsmouth, they say that the universe is infinite, in which case it's not expanding into anything because it is everything, which is a really horrible thing to think about. But I have two ways to try and explain this to you to help it. So imagine, when we talk about infinity and the universe being infinite, imagine numbers. Imagine that you wrote out every single number. What's the biggest number that you can write out? Right? There isn't a biggest number because you can always add one onto it and you can keep on going forever. But then you could multiply, you could write out all those numbers and then you could multiply them by two. And then you still have all the numbers, but their sum would be bigger. So that, I don't know if that helps when thinking about infinity. It kind of helped me at the time. But the other thing when I think about this is if you imagine that you're an ant living on a piece of string that we've attached the end, so it's living on a loop of string. Now that ant can go forwards and backwards along the string, and it can go left and right, and it can loop round the string, but it can't go up and down. It doesn't know about that other dimension. And so maybe we live in a universe where there's more dimensions, and so we just don't understand our universe well enough to understand what it's expanding into. I'm going to hope that someone else is going to jump in to see if we can get to the bottom of this.
I can try and add a little bit. I think this is, out of all the questions we've had, well, the hardest question that we've been able to answer, as posed by a 10-year-old, of course. And sometimes I just sort of try and think back to the person who kind of first came up with the idea that space could do weird things like expanding and stretching and stuff, which is Albert Einstein. And if we imagine ourselves sitting in this room, and you think this room has a certain size, it has a certain length and a certain width and a certain height, but Einstein was someone who thought about it and thought, maybe that's not true. And actually, depending how you're moving, like how fast you're going, this room could be a different size. It doesn't actually have, if you say, how big is this room? That's not a question that just has one single answer. It depends how fast you're going. The distance could be smaller or could be larger. And that's not exactly about space expanding, but just thinking about space not even being necessarily the same for me as for someone who's running really fast towards that wall, but just being relative, as Einstein said, that kind of helps me a little bit to think about it, because then I stop thinking about space as being in anything, and I just kind of think, well, space is just a distance from here to there, and I've got an idea of what it is, and someone else who's moving at different speed has a totally different idea of what it is. And because it's the space itself, it's not exactly in anything, if that's a good answer. Somebody help.
Well, there's a nice analogy to actually carry on from your ants on a string. If you had three slices of bread and you hung them from a knitting needle and put some ants on the right-hand side of each of them, they're sort of, like we said, in a two-dimensional universe, aren't they? And they wouldn't know about the other ants on the side, that side of that piece of bread or that side of that piece of bread. Now, we, looking at that, say, ah, those are just three two-dimensional universes in another further dimension, because our brains are good enough to actually understand and think in three dimensions. In just the same way, our universe could be one of myriads of universes that coexist in this further dimension. And string theory has some ideas about that.
I think I'll stop at that point. I'll start to go.
I've got another analogy.
We'll move on to the next question, which is actually not a question. So, Chris Walker, would you like to explain a bit about what this is?
Yeah, if you notice, it's a photograph or a series of photographs that I took of the seven sisters, the Pleiades. Now, normally, I take a series of photos, and to increase the signal to noise, I stack them. But I did make a final photograph of this, and it looked really good, but I went back to it because on one of the photos, I could notice there was a green blob. And, I mean, I've taken lots and lots of photos, and usually I don't see things I don't understand. But this object, it can't be like something that's the same distance as the shuttle, because it would be moving far faster. It can't be something that's the same distance as, say, the moon, otherwise it would be moving far slower. So it's green, it looks gaseous. What on earth is it?
So, just to be clear, you're referring to this moving object here.
Yes.
No, and not that moving object there.
No.
And not that moving object there. And there's another one down here somewhere where it seems to be moving too. So I think there are actually a couple of different things that are happening here. Oh, here's another one up here. First of all, you have some things which seem to be moving relative to stars, but are actually stationary relative to the frame. I think those might be just bad pixels or hot pixels in your camera. These bluish things look like there's some sort of internal reflection. So Fiona pointed out when we looked at this that these things actually are in the same arrangement, and there are quite a few of them if you look more carefully. They're in the same arrangement as the Pleiades, but just reversed. So that's probably an internal reflection. Now, as for Mr. Fuzzy Green thing, my thought on that is that it may actually be scattered light from some building or some site nearby. So did you take this photo in space?
No. The site that I have is quite far away from any light pollution. So, and I wasn't aware of any lasers shining in the sky or anything like that. But my guess was that the way it's moving in polar orbit, was it could possibly be a Soviet communication satellites, because they don't use geostationary satellites. They use three polar orbit, in long polar orbit, satellites, so that you get two in there, two above the poles at any one time. And could it be, I mean, I don't know, could it be that they've released some hydrazine or something like that? I don't know what color hydrazine is.
Okay, if you were in an absolutely dark site that and you're absolutely certain there are no lights anywhere that you could see, you couldn't see like your hand in front of your face.
Just about.
It's likely that may not be scattered light from an Earth-based object. However, there's also the remote possibility, although potentially real, that it's scattered light from another object in the sky. As we can see, the Pleiades produce their own inverse pattern on this picture as well. And there may be other nearby bright stars, like there's Alpha Taurus, for example, which is a fairly bright red thing, which could be responsible for this weird green thing, or one of the planets. But my best guess is that this is something to do with scattered light inside the optics of the camera.
Do we know how long it took from the first frame to the last frame, the time?
Approximately, I did write it up, but I think it's 22 minutes, I think it was, something like that.
Yeah, I don't think it could be a satellite.
I was thinking if there's some kind of reflected light or scattered light, whether it would match, depending on your telescope, because also depending on the mount of your telescope, you're going to be seeing the ground differently in your telescope. If you're tracking the sky, then the elevation of the ground or the angular distance of the ground from your telescope will be changing, and that could potentially cause something to move across the frame. But yeah. you'd be able to know that from the time it took.
Yeah, but I've never seen anything, you know, taking similar photos like that before.
Could you show the next slide, which is, I screen grabbed one of the pictures from the video and got rid of the light pollution, as I know my friend has on his full picture. I also just increased the brightness of the little green blob. Can you see it better there than you could before? Okay, well, it's green. I mean, I started in a very simple-minded way, as I am. The things that are fuzzy and glow green are comets, because you get cyanogen and also molecular carbon that give off the green colour, and some lovely pictures showing the green. I think comet Catalina showed some green quite recently. Anyway, you could then do some sums. I worked out what's called the image scale of the picture, which is how many pixels how many arc seconds corresponds to one pixel of the image. Next slide. And actually, I don't know if you can see, that's a complete blow-up of the green blob. And the first thing you can work out very simply is that each pixel is about 10 arc seconds across. The overall width of this is about 5, so it's about 50 arc seconds across. Can you see it's elongated? Now, the stars, there are not many in this, but they're point objects. They're brilliant, which means I think you were auto-guiding very well. I mean, they were superb images. And so you can actually work out from this roughly how long the exposures were, which was a couple of minutes or so, which is good. Okay, now, if you know the number of pixels across, you've got the angular size, okay? What you can then do, well, supposing it was a comet. They typically have a coma about 50,000 kilometres across. From that, you can work out how far away it is. It, in principle, will be about 1.3 astronomical units further away from the Sun. Fine. Except that you can then work out how fast it's moving. And if it were there, it'd be moving an awful lot faster than any comets move at that distance from the Sun. So it cannot be a comet. So I just think it's an alien craft, which is highly as a green fuzzy blob, so you don't know what it is.
And if any of the listeners have more photos of aliens, do send them to the Jodcast. And that'll fill the next 10 years of episodes. This is a bespoke service. I hope you appreciate the amount of work that's gone into this.
Thank you very much for that. So the next question was asked by Paul Stevenson, who is unfortunately not here, so I'm going to ask it on his behalf. And the question is, what is the cause of the highly inclined orbital axis of many of the hot Jupiters that have been found to date? Does this imply that we are not only in a Goldilocks zone, but a Goldilocks system? I think I'll throw that at you, Chris.
Sure. So I heard a talk at a conference about a month ago that completely changed how I think about the solar system, and which helps answer this question. So you have to think, we used to think of our solar system as a nice, boring, stable, lovely place to sit in which the planets move like clockwork. But if you go back four or maybe 5 billion years, it's not like that. We know, for example, now, we think now, that there were 20 things the size of Mars knocking around the inner solar system. And their collisions and interactions led to what we see today. It gave us the Moon. That was a collision with the Earth. It led to the strangeness of Venus's rotation, the fact it's very slow, and so on. But it's a chaotic system, more like a pinball machine with lots of pinballs than anything nice and orderly. And so once these things start interacting, they affect each other. And one of the things you might expect to happen is that some of the planets or some of the forming planets would be thrown up into highly inclined orbits. So then you have to ask, well, why for these hot Jupiters, these systems where we see big planets close to their star, why are they on inclined orbits out of the plane and our planets are here? It's really a function of how much stuff there is. So the talk that I heard put solar systems on a range of sort of initial density. And so if you don't have much stuff, you form a few boring planets. If you have loads of stuff, you form so many pinballs that you're almost bound to get these highly inclined orbits, and you also get these hot Jupiters which have migrated inwards. And then we're right in the middle, where we had enough stuff in our protosolar system to form a nice array of planets, 8 or 9 or 10, or however many you want to count, depending on your definition. But not enough to produce hot Jupiters and these highly inclined orbits. So what's nice about that is there's a prediction there that as we keep finding these things, we should find more and more of them on highly inclined orbits, and we'll be able to test that very shortly.
Great. Does anyone else want to add to that? I don't. Heard it from the best.
It's obviously if you talk for long enough that people forget what the question is. That's key in these sessions.
Does it make you think that solar systems like ours are common or very rare?
Well, somebody asked that question, and we don't really know, although I've talked about us being in the middle, I don't think we know yet how sensitive that parameter is. So it may be that there are loads of solar systems sitting where we are. It may be that you have to get exactly the right density of stuff to get there. So I don't think we know yet. But it does suggest that we shouldn't be surprised that there's no hot Jupiter here, and that our gas planets are well-behaved and firmly placed in the outer solar system.
Okay. So the next question is from Tom. Tom Shepard.
NASA plans to retire the space station in a decade or so in order to pay for a trip to Mars. Is this a good trade-off?
So to take a kind of extra grumpy approach to this question, I actually don't think that either the International Space Station or a manned mission to Mars are the best things to do in terms of space exploration at the moment, in any case. And this is just because it costs a lot more money, and it's just technically much more difficult to send stuff into space with human beings than it is to just send automated rovers or automated telescopes or other unmanned missions into space. And I think one of the best examples of just how much value you can get out of an unmanned mission are the Spirit and Opportunity rovers on Mars. NASA put out a press release last month, which was basically reminding people that Opportunity is still around. It's still going. After 12 years of being on the Martian surface, we have some people in the audience who were born after Opportunity landed and have not known a Mars without Opportunity just making its way across the surface. That's how much value you can get out of an unmanned mission. You can't stick a person on Mars and hope that nothing goes wrong on your mission, like a unit conversion error, which happened with one of the NASA missions to Mars. You can't like stick somebody on Mars and expect them to be there for a couple of months and say, oh, can we like squeeze another 12 years of science out of you? Because they're going to run out of food or air.
Send them enough potatoes. I think that's what we learned from the Martian.
Well, that's true. There is a Matt Damon. You can send Matt Damon. You will make it work for 12 years.
If we get to choose who to send, I think it's an excellent trade-off. but I think, you know, there's no doubt that our first questioner is wearing a Principia shirt in honor of Tim Peake's mission. And I think, you know, you don't do manned spaceflight for science. You do manned spaceflight because it's fun and inspiring. And because it makes people think and reminds them that the universe is out there and that we can explore it. So would a Mars mission do a better job of that than the space station? Yeah, I think so. I think before Tim Peake went up there, we'd mostly forgotten that the space station existed in this country. In the US, it's the same thing. When things go wrong, people pay attention briefly. So a Mars mission, I think, would be worth it. Whether you can get a Mars mission for the cost of the International Space Station, I'm not sure. If somebody's offering you that trade and you believe them, grab it with both hands. The problem is getting the politicians to fund a Mars mission.
It's interesting because we did talk about this subject at the last Jodcast Live, so we're still it still obviously is an interesting thing to talk about, sending a crewed mission to Mars.
And it's clearly still an unresolved question as well.
Yeah.
After 5 years, we still don't have consensus on whether or not this is a good idea.
Well, the last time Chris mentioned the one person, one trip, one way or something.
That's right, yeah, that was the American...
Are you volunteering?
I would go.
Mind your show of hands, how many would go on a one-way trip
to Mars?
Hang on,
we've got two conditions. So it's a one-way trip to Mars, but we promise you'll stay alive, and you can keep the internet, albeit at a dime. So with those conditions, who would go? Yeah, somebody's got two hands up, so he's first.
So that's the majority of people. I kept my hand down, I've got to say.
Right, that's fine. Well, you can... did any of the Jodcast team want to stay with Jen? Because we
that's a loaded question.
No, I'm just making sure we've still got a Jodcast.
We'll always have Milan, Jen.
And I didn't put my hand up because I might not even last 12 years. So.
But when just think about what has come from manned missions into space, when we think of the technical advances like Teflon, like memory foam, like all of the science and the engineering that we use in our everyday lives that has come from that goal of going into space would just be magnified by going to Mars, I would have thought, because you've got that tremendous engineering challenge of getting someone there, keeping them alive, and potentially getting them back. I think that there's an awful lot of very exciting engineering that could come from that.
Well, it's also the capability of us being a multi-planet species, not just being on Earth, I think.
Yeah.
Well, if we were to do more than just space exploration, if we were to actually settle, or if we were to do things that were much more complicated than just a robot, then, yeah, I would be all for sending a manned mission to Mars. If we're just going to go there and, like, poke some rocks, we can send an unmanned mission to do that.
Well, we've got to start somewhere, right?
The Galactic Empire needs to start somewhere.
but I think you behave differently as a person. I mean, maybe AI will improve by the time we get to Mars. But there are nice hybrid ideas. So the Planetary Society in the US has been promoting the idea that you want to explore Mars scientifically before we go and ruin it by putting people all over it. But you also want to take advantage of human presence. So the way you do that is you put a space station on Phobos, Mars's moon. From there, you can easily control rovers on the ground. And you essentially have an excellent remote control playground for your little robot toys as you orbit above the surface of Mars. And I think that, you know, there are clever hybrids that take advantage of both. What we need is to pretend there's oil there, or
I hear it's a good site for Donald Trump's next golf course.
I think before we get into
Donald Trump,
yes,
yeah, let's send Donald Trump to Mars.
Sally is urgently looking.
Yeah, I'm not going to delve into politics. The next two questions, in fact, have both been about gravitational waves, and the first person, Stephen Roderick, wasn't able to join us either. But I think I'll maybe ask for sort of a general introduction to gravitational waves, and hopefully you all know that they detected them. But if somebody would like to sort of lead that and just tell us what it was and how they found them.
Wow. I nominate Chris for the recent discovery, because he talked about them while spotting penguins in Antarctica. So.
Sure. So I... Gravitational waves are a very simple idea, which is that space, if you think of space as a substance, it can ripple. And so you can have a wave that's travelling through space. And so then there are two questions you should ask. One is, what would cause such a thing? And the answer, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, is that anything with mass that moves causes a ripple in space. So as the Earth goes around the Sun, there will be a gravitational wave that spreads out into the universe. And so then the next question you should ask is, will these waves be big? Should we think of the Earth as rather like a ship on a stormy ocean being tossed around? And actually, that's not quite right, because space, although it can have these waves travelling through it, is very, very, very stiff. So even if you give it a huge bang, you don't get much of a ripple. And so the only gravitational waves that we should expect to be able to detect are those from very big things doing dramatic things. And so a good example of that is when two supermassive black holes, the kind of black holes that we have at the centre of galaxies, collide. And that happened. It happened a long way away. And it caused a gravitational wave that travelled towards the Earth and was detected by a very sensitive instrument called LIGO. The LIGO team announced this first detection of a ripple in space just the other day. It's the result of 40 years' worth of work. I think the other thing I should do before we get to questions is give you an idea of how hard that was. And to give you the best way I know of telling you this is that LIGO is capable of detecting the gravitational pull of a cloud passing over it. And in fact, the signal from that cloud is much stronger than the ripple that they're trying to detect from two black holes colliding. So that gives you an idea of how difficult this is. And the announcement that they've managed to do it is hugely exciting.
Wow.
Absolutely. one perhaps should stick up for Jodrell Bank. Although this was the first time that gravitational waves have been directly detected, prior to that there have been two detections of gravitational waves being produced, in the first case by a neutron star going around an ordinary star, and in the case of the Jodrell Bank observations, of two co-rotating neutron stars or pulsars. Because we know that the emission of gravitational waves takes energy out of the system, Einstein's theory predicts that the two objects should gradually spiral in towards each other. And the theory at the moment says that the orbits of these two pulsars that we've detected ought to be reducing by about 7 millimeters per day. And that's exactly what we find. So there have been two indirect detections previously, but this is a fantastic result.
And I think this is what people got wrong in a lot of the press coverage of this fabulous announcement, which is that people said, this is proof that gravitational waves exist. And actually, we knew that because we'd seen their effects. What this does is allow us to look out into the universe in a new way and say, ah, something happened there, and something
still
happened
brilliant.
Over there.
And another high five to pulsars.
Yes.
And of course, pulsars are still being used to try and detect gravitational waves in a more direct way now as well.
Yes. Yeah, so gravitational waves, depending on the size of the object, it changes the frequency of the gravitational wave. And so different sized objects are probed by different types of detectors. So LIGO is sort of binary black holes. If you go into space, LISA will soon be hopefully up and doing things, which will be on a slightly bigger scales.
LISA is a spaceship, not a person.
LISA is a person. LISA is a mission that's going to measure. It's basically like LIGO, but on a much bigger scale in the solar system as an interferometer. If you go to even larger scales, there's a pulsar timing arrays. There's about three of them around the world. And I think Australia, Europe, and America will have pulsar timing arrays, which are basically trying to use pulsars and the signals we detect from pulsars, because they're very good clocks. Use those as arms of an interferometer, well, not quite an interferometer, but use them for timing in different directions and see if we can see very, very large-scale gravitational waves, things that are affecting very, very big scales, much bigger than our solar system. So that's another thing. And also, people might remember BICEP 2 experiment in 2014, I think it was. It also claimed to have detected gravitational waves. It turned out that wasn't true. Planck came up with some more data to show that it's actually dust in our Milky Way that was the cause of that. But that was looking, and it's still a possibility, is looking for gravitational wave signatures, how they affect the cosmic microwave background. So these would be gravitational waves which are on the largest scale in the universe, basically using the whole universe as an experiment to look for how they make very subtle changes to the polarization in the cosmic microwave background that we detect, which could potentially tell us about the very early universe, and is one of the points of a prediction of inflation that you should be able to detect these signals. So
I think we'll go to the question at this point.
Sorry.
So, Mark Gray?
I'd just like to also say thanks for letting me be here today. I live local, I'm a long-time listener, and you can imagine I'm utterly thrilled. I'd like to say thanks to everybody who's helped make it happen today. Cheers, guys. Thanks. You were alluding to the start of where we're going. So now that we've observed gravitational waves, can we use them to observe the birth of the universe?
So yeah, sorry for anticipating that. I think I would say yes. It's still very much at the edges of what we could potentially do, and we're not really there yet. As BICEP 2 showed, we need to have a very good idea about the things that are between us and the distant universe, which is everything, basically. And you need to have a very good idea about what that is. If we are going to detect that signal. But I think the cosmic microwave background, potentially pulsar timing arrays, if they go to big enough scales, would have a handle on that sort of very early universe scale of gravitational waves.
Yeah, the way to think about it, as Stuart's saying, is if you think about my analogy of being on a ship in a choppy ocean, what LIGO's detecting, what this new detection is sort of the each and every swell that you go up and down as you bounce across the waves. What you need to detect to understand the early universe is sort of the deep, long swells of the ocean. And so you use a different set of tools for that. So this doesn't help us get there, but it does increase the excitement and allows us to see more of sort of the intermediate universes. So one of the things we'll want to answer with LIGO is how often do these black holes collide? And that tells you something about how galaxies form, which tells you something about what's happened in the 13.8 billion years since the very early universe.
Electromagnetic radiation can only see as far back as about 380,000 years after the origin, because you come across the fog, which was the what gives rise, in fact, to the cosmic microwave background. Gravitational waves are the only thing that would allow you to probe any further back in the life of the universe. Just quickly, a sort of an analogy that the youngsters might like about how LIGO works. I regard that event as a sort of a gravitational wave tsunami. I mean, an enormous wave. If you had two ships about 4 kilometres apart with a laser measuring the separation between them on the sea, and if a tsunami wave came along, can you see the first little ship's going to bob around? That would give you a little signal. The wave then comes to this one, it would bob around the other way around, so you'd actually be able to measure the fact that a tsunami was coming. But of course, if a tsunami came at that angle, with the two ships at right angles, you wouldn't actually see anything because they both do this. But of course, if you had another arm at right angles, then you'd be bound to get it. And that's a sort of a crude analogy as to how LIGO works.
I was just going to add, the CMB does let you see back before 380,000 years, but you're inferring that, whereas gravitational waves would, if we could detect them in the cosmic microwave background, would be a bit more of a direct look back.
So it's probably worth mentioning that you do learn things about, because of the fact that we haven't detected gravitational waves in the cosmic microwave background as well. So because they aren't loud enough for us to have already detected, we can already say things about the physics of inflation.
Yep.
Okay.
It's always important to care about when results aren't what you expect.
Okay, and the next question. I can't find it. There you are. Ben.
Yes.
Is there really a Planet Nine?
People are looking at me.
we should probably say what Planet Nine is, because this is not a question about Pluto.
Which is no longer a planet.
Which is a dwarf planet, one of the five currently known dwarf planets.
It's dynamically different.
Yep. So we're down to 8 planets again since 2006. I just want to add in there, we have had far more than 9 planets in the past because we've redefined things quite a lot over 400 years. We at one point had 16 planets, so don't think that the most we ever had was 9. But this new one is two astronomers in America, Mike Brown and I've forgotten...
Constantine Petinian.
Thank you very much. Have inferred the presence of another planet from... the data they're looking at. I'll let you...
Before we get onto that, can I just bring up another Jocast memory? because Mike Brown, most people will know of as Pluto Killer, and there was, because he was one of the people who discovered Eris, another dwarf planet, that led ultimately to Pluto's regrading, I won't say downgrading, regrading. But one of the wonderful Jocast pantos that we did was a variation on Snow White.
So it was Nicky White and... Neil White and the Seven Dwarf Planets.
Yes, and so as part of that, I think Megan was Pluto, and I managed to get Mike Brown to send us a little bit of audio pretending to be, like, the sort of parent of the dwarf planets, and just so that we would make Megan say daddy for some reason. I can't remember that. That's an ongoing joke ever since. So thank you, Mike Brown, for sending in some rather strange audio for us.
To follow that...
if one can.
I think returning to the question... Yeah, so what... Mike studies the outer solar system, and he, and it should be said lots of other people, had noticed that 6 of the most distant things that we know out there, in particular one called Sedna, but other things that are in some weird orbits, were all in the same part of the sky. And their orbits, which are elliptical, took them out in the same direction. So it's kind of weird that all 6 of them headed in the same direction. And so he might walk down the hall to see Constantine, who's a theorist who runs computer models of how things behave in the solar system, and said, okay, try and explain this. And you start off by trying to say, okay, do these things interact with each other? Well, there aren't enough of them, for example, for their gravity to have enough effect to do that. And you can come up with some other solutions. But one of the things you could try and do is put in another planet whose gravitational pull will start affecting the orbits of these 6 weird outer solar system objects. It turns out that if you put in a planet that's about 10 times the size of the Earth, 10 times the mass of the Earth, and you put it on an elliptical orbit in the opposite part of the sky to the 6 weird ones, then you can explain why these things are out there. So this is a prediction that this planet, which we're calling Planet 9, or as a friend of mine had it, Pluto, is out there in the outer solar system. And so that idea has been around, but what Mike and Constantine did just a month or so ago was produce the first proper simulations that show this idea worked. And so I was lucky enough to go and talk to them for the BBC. I think it's still on iPlayer, on another show. And I went out as a bit of a skeptic, because this is a nice idea, and all right, it's a computer simulation, but we need to find this thing. But it turns out there's another thing that the computer model predicts. It predicts there should be another set of objects moving at right angles to the plane of the solar system. So these are things that have had an encounter at some point with Planet 9, and they get kicked up out of the solar system. And the thing that I find very convincing is that these things exist. So there are known objects on these weird perpendicular orbits. So we've now got two sets of weird orbits that can be explained for the low, low price of one large planet in the outer solar system. And then it turns out that if this thing is 10 times the size of the Earth, and it's made of vaguely normal stuff like Uranus and Neptune are, and it's on the outer bit of its orbit, then we wouldn't have seen it yet. It's faint enough that it's plausible that it had been missed, but bright enough that we should be able to see it if we knew exactly where it was. And so there are astronomers who have gone out looking for this. I know that there's telescope time being used to try and find this thing. So I'm convinced that this thing exists. I became convinced over the course of a day talking to Mike and Constantine, who really believe in it. And I think we'll know in the next 5 years, because somebody will either find it or will have built a survey telescope that's good enough to rule it out. But the idea that there's another big planet out there is, I think, really exciting. We're going to have so much fun arguing over about what to call it.
I love this this finding, or this hopeful finding, because it reminds us that even though we think that we know everything that's going on in our solar system, and, you know, a lot of the time we're studying the stars and the galaxies out there beyond, there is still so much that we don't know about sort of our backyard. And I love being able to go into schools. Every school I've been into, the children have known about this. And to be able to say, yes, you're learning about your eight planets, but as Stuart was saying, you know, it's been different in the past. It will be different in the future. When you grow up, if you become astronomers, we may have changed the rules again. You know, the least interesting thing about Pluto is the fact that it's a dwarf planet. And you were still finding out so much about it. And if there is Planet 9, and I don't know if there'd be any other planets out there, it's absolutely wonderful that we're reminded of this.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed the surprise of people when I was talking to people about this. And as you say, people heard that there was this new planet. People were agog and incredulous at the idea that astronomers could have missed this thing. And I found myself having conversations in which I said things like, well, astronomy's hard. Space is big. Planets are small. There's still potentially a huge amount that's out there that we don't know about. And I think we're less actually... The Jogcast is very good at doing this, but in the media in general, we're very bad at pointing out what we don't know. And I think, you know, if you just read the headlines and you see this long trail of astronomy discoveries, I mean, half of them are water on Mars, but nonetheless, you just see this long trail of discoveries, I think you forget that there's a lot of unexplored space out there.
Can I just ask a question of you, Chris, or anyone, really? If we think we've got an idea where it might be in the sky, is it worth proposing a mission to go and visit now? I mean, not it won't launch now, but hopefully we might have found it by the time we need to launch.
I think if it was going to take 30 years to find it, I think that might make some sense. LSST, which is a survey telescope that will come on stream in about 5 years' time, will find this in the first year of operation or rule it out. So either we'll find it in the next few years or LSST will pick it up. So I think it's worth waiting. I think what's interesting is the competition to try and find it. So it's about, it's faint, but it should be visible in an 8-meter telescope, and it moves about 2 arc seconds a night, its apparent motion should be. So about, what's that, one, almost a 2,000th of a degree, but that's just about detectable.
So it wasn't the thing in his film.
No, I'm just thinking. But no, we can rule that out, luckily. But the point is, it's just on the edge of being discovered, so if it's real. So I think we should go looking for it first. Getting a mission there is not easy.
No.
It's a long way out. So in 2,500 years' time, it will be much closer. But that's probably a little too long to wait.
Okay, and so from our solar system to another solar system, is Ian Wilkinson here?
All of our units require knowledge of something intrinsic to Earth. For example, light years, astronomical units and parsecs. Can you suggest a unit that would make sense if you weren't born in this solar system?
So I liked this question a whole lot when I heard it, and I instantly had an idea for an answer. It may actually be useful to talk about, first, the definition of the meter, which was originally supposed to be like some really, really small fraction of the circumference of the Earth, as defined by France in the 19th century, I think. And they tried to make it this really precise number, I forget, like 1/10 millionth or something like that. I can't remember the exact number. And then they discovered, well, like quite a few years later, well, it's like the Earth isn't quite that same size as the meter, so as we define the meter as. So we'll have to find a different definition. And so through most of the 20th century, the definition of the meter was actually based on so many wavelengths of emission from an isotope of krypton. Now, in so this actually gets my answer. We can actually define a lot of standard units of measurement based on the emission of electromagnetic radiation from atoms, and we're fairly certain that the physics of that emission will not change over time. Those lines might be redshifted, but if we agree on the definition of, well, it's like we just have like the atoms at rest and they produce this wavelength, then it's like no matter which alien civilization we have, we'll be able to measure the same wavelength of emission. One of the favorite wavelengths of radiation in this respect is the 21 centimeter line from hydrogen, which is a very common radio astronomy line, and it's produced by the most common elements in the universe. And it's any civilization which has some sort of level of electronic technology is going to be able to pick up this type of hydrogen line emission and is going to know about its existence. And in fact, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence likes to look for alien civilizations at multiples of this 21 centimeter line of radiation. So I think one of my favorites in this respect is looking for alien signals at the 21 centimeter line multiplied by pi or divided by pi. Because if you have an alien civilization trying to transmit 21 centimeters itself, that will get lost in all of the other hydrogen in the Milky Way. But if they want to be found, they'll multiply that by another universal number, and pi is another one of these universal numbers where every advanced civilization should be able to come up with, like, the ratio of the diameter to circumference in the circle as the same number.
Yeah. The plaque that was drawn by Carl Sagan's wife that went out on the two Pioneer probes used the wavelength of hydrogen, 21 centimetres, as the length scale. And there was a picture of a gentleman and a lady, which didn't go down too well with the American Ladies' League of Decency, but nevertheless, that basically gave that little height like that above them, and in terms of the hydrogen line, that was their height.
The trouble is, this is a terrible unit for astronomy. I'm sorry, because my thoughts went down a similar route as you were asking the question, and small units are kind of easy. But if we're going to talk to alien civilizations on equal terms, I'm going to want to ask them questions about galaxies and cosmology. You can get on to...
Well, you can multiply...
Well, you can, but...
You can multiply this by a really, really large number if you want to measure distances between stars. But at least you have a measurement which both you and some other alien civilization...
I think that's great, but it would be nice to have a natural unit that's large.
There's probably the Hubble radius. It's probably
the what?
The Hubble radius, so the distance to the last scattering surface.
Isn't that time-dependent, though?
Well, that is time-dependent, whereas like these atomic phenomena, people have studied the physics, and they think the atomic phenomena actually stay very constant over time.
Mm.
or in terms of the evolution of the universe.
So this has only really given us a scale for length, though.
If you wanted to find a universal scale for time, now, it's like you'd sort of have to get your alien civilization to agree to this, but you could say how long it takes light to travel one wavelength, for one hydrogen wavelength.
Yeah.
The speed of light in the vacuum is a constant. That's length divided by time. The length of this hydrogen line is a constant, so if you take the length and divide by the speed of light, you'll get a time unit out. Again, it's another very small time unit. There are other things as well.
I might interject here. So speaking of time, in my role as Time Lord for this afternoon's activities, I think we probably do need to move on from this segment now, if that's
Thank
okay.
Thank you. You said it better than I was going to say.
It's good to know segues are alive and well in the John Cast.
I'd like to thank you all for your questions, and I'm sorry to anybody that didn't get to ask their question. And thank you to our panel for answering those questions.